Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. It's test day for The Pulse team.
All right, personality quiz, take one.
That's our producer, Lindsay Lazarski.
Finally, a personality quiz backed by science.
Reporter Alan Yu.
Big Five test.
And Jed Slayman. They are taking a test called the Big Five. It's one of the few personality tests you can take online that has actual, real science behind it, as opposed to those tests that tell you which frozen character you are. I'm Olaf, by the way. For the Big Five, you agree or disagree with different statements about your personality. Dozens of them.
I am compassionate and have a soft heart.
Question one. I tend to be quiet.
I am emotionally stable and not easily upset. I wish.
You respond with how well it fits or doesn't.
Sure, yeah. I'm gonna agree a little.
Agree strongly.
Disagree on that.
I also took the test.
I tend to be disorganized. No. I worry a lot. Yes.
At the end, it spits out five scores that assess your level of different big umbrella personality traits. It measures your extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, openness, and conscientiousness. Maybe you can think of these categories a bit like the primary colors that you can use to create a million different shades.
All right, let's go right to the numbers. Agreeableness, 83 out of 100.
75 out of 100 on conscientiousness, and 8 out of 100 on extroversion.
Openness to experience is my highest, 88 out of 100, and conscientiousness is my lowest, 28 out of 100.
You also get little explainers as to what high, low, or medium scores might mean for your life.
Some scientists think low extroversion has protected humans from disease. You can't pick up a bug from people if you avoid people. That's quite relevant now.
Low conscientiousness, when combined with a high score on openness, that's me, is associated with an increased risk of substance use disorders. Ooh. You're also likely to be creative, so go ahead and be the life of the party occasionally. Thank you, personality quiz.
Love to talk about our personalities, to try to figure out what makes us tick. But what exactly is personality? On today's episode, how personality forms and how it impacts our lives. Also, can we change who we are at our core? First up, let's take a very quick spin through history and look at some of the ideas that humans have had about personality over the centuries. The ancient Greeks tied personality to four different bodily fluids.
Blood, yellow bile, phlegm, and black bile.
That's Johnny Bunning. He's a historian of science. He says the Greeks thought these fluids gave people different attributes. Blood was associated with being enthusiastic or social, phlegm with apathy, and it was all about the right mixture.
And that the correct distribution and balance of these humors created a healthy person, both in terms of physiological health and what we would call mental health.
This idea that different fluids inside of the body brought about different personalities stuck around for a very long time.
And we, in fact, still use this terminology in some cases. So if you say someone is sanguine, they're optimistic, you know, relatively happy, that sangue from blood. Similarly, if you say someone is melancholic, that is, in fact, a reference to this humoral theory of black bile.
And phlegmatic, I guess.
And phlegmatic also, absolutely, yes.
You know, unemotional or sluggish. In the early 19th century, German physician Franz Gall mapped out people's heads, like countries divided by distinct borders. And he argued that different areas were associated with traits like combativeness or constructiveness. This became known as phrenology. I'm sure you've seen those ceramic heads with the different regions.
And it's quite reductive in the sense that the size of those parts is taken to determine the expression or the force of any particular trait.
Later, psychologists like Sigmund Freud or Carl Jung developed their theories on personality. And while the ideas have continued to change, what has remained constant is the desire to understand ourselves in this way, to create categories.
There's many attempts to try and create tangible, legible, seemingly objective expressions that allow you to get traction on something that is extremely slippery.
Can you really nail down personality in a scientific way? Is this something you can actually measure? Jad Slaman talked to scientists who say brain imaging could bring us some new insights.
Neuroscientist Emily Finn and her team were using this enormous, unprecedented pile of brain data, MRI and fMRI scans matched with questionnaires and demographic info. It's from this massive data collection called the Human Connectome.
The idea was to kind of create a really large database that could be mined by lots of different research groups to try to understand the general blueprint for the human brain and how it's wired.
The Connectome is sort of like the Human Genome Project, but for brains. It collects data about people and their brains for scientists to pore over. There's more than 1,200 brains in the Connectome now, but Emily's team was working with an early release years ago with data from around 120 people. They were interested in what brains looked like when they did different types of things, how they lit up when a subject was trying to remember a sequence of numbers or 13, reading a passage of story 40, out loud.
21. 17, 18,
we were kind of putting all the data into a big algorithm, and it was supposed to, you know, give us out, okay, this is a pattern from, you know, the language task, or this is a pattern from the memory task.
They figured brains would light up in similar ways when they did similar tasks. But for some reason, the computer didn't want to group according to task.
We kept on getting subjects. So, you know, the algorithm kept wanting to group together patterns from the same person, regardless of what that person was actually doing while the data was acquired.
Instead of
language task, memory task, social task,
it was always
Robert, Robert, Robert.
It's basically the exact opposite of what they had expected. But no matter what a person's brain was doing, it seemed to be doing the task in a way that was unique to that person. It's a bit like no matter what word you write, it's always in your handwriting.
You think about sort of a map of connections, you know, between every possible pair of regions in the brain. We noticed that those were really unique to individuals. You always kind of look most like yourself, regardless of what you're doing.
The team wasn't looking for anything related to personality, but in these stable patterns of brain activity, it seems like they had found a glimpse of it.
You can think of personality as a lens through which we experience the world, and we can, you know, we all know, I mean, it's a fact of human nature that many of us can see the same thing and feel completely differently about it. You know, we can be exposed to the same information and form completely different opinions. And that's a product of, you know, our own experiences and our own situations, but also, you know, potentially this intrinsic biological component of personality.
The Connectome had all those brain scans, as well as personality test results. The Big Five questionnaire that measure people's extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, openness, and conscientiousness. Emily and her team found that a person's particular brain patterns could predict reasonably well some of their Big Five traits. Their work, though, was possible only relatively recently. Personality researchers say brain imaging in the past was too noisy, too imprecise to tell us anything about an individual's personality. You had to look at a lot of different scans of different people and take the averages to try to get an accurate picture of how the brain works. But with better imaging machines and better data processing, scientists are now able to get a more precise look. It's helped give rise to a new field, personality neuroscience.
You know, the term personality neuroscience didn't come along until maybe around 2009 or so.
That's Colin DeYoung, a psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. Part of personality neuroscience sort of matches brain imaging with these personality tests. Colin's team found that the brains of people with different personalities were measurably different in relation to four of the big five traits. Conscientiousness, for example, the trait that makes you more organized and disciplined, seems to be associated with this circuit Colin and his team have only recently identified.
A circuit that involves the prefrontal cortex and also the insula, and you know, a bunch of brain regions that I could list, but that wouldn't mean something to most people who weren't neuroscientists.
What's important is that people with strong connections between these regions score really high on conscientiousness pretty consistently. Another example is extroversion. Folks who score high also tend to have very active dopamine systems. Dopamine signals potential rewards, which can change the way you look at a crowded party. Whereas an introvert might see strangers and painful small talk, an extrovert sees walking, talking, potential rewards.
They're going to look around and see a bunch of people, and every one of these people that they look at is a potential for something interesting to happen, right? Like, oh, I might go talk to that person, or I don't know him, I'd like to meet him.
So you can see personality in how someone acts at a party. You can see it in their test scores, and you can even see it in the brain. But where do they come from, these different brains and the personalities that go with them? Both scientists tell me it's a combination of genes and experience. Babies, for example, don't have much experience, but they do have different genes. Here's Colin again.
You know, one baby might tend to cry a lot, and another might be very calm, and one might be very energetic, and another might be more, you know, relaxed and lethargic.
You might call these factory settings that we're born with. They're not quite personality. Most researchers call them temperament. Colin says we start developing analogs of big five personality traits in childhood.
Some of them are more imaginative and curious than others. That would be reflecting what we call in adults openness and intellect. Others are more empathetic and really react to other people's emotions.
That empathy is tied to agreeableness in adults. The older we get, the more time we have for our genetics to play out.
Intelligence is like that, or IQ is often measured. So, and that's partly because your genes basically are shaping the mechanisms that you're going to use to be learning over time. People who have a higher IQ are generally better at learning things. So the longer you give for people to learn, the more those differences actually play out in the end product.
Big events like your first major disappointment, your first romantic relationship, or getting your first job. Studies show these experiences seem to have a lasting effect on your personality and measurable effects on the brain.
But the thing is that it doesn't matter whether it's your genes that are having an influence on your personality or it's your environment that's having an influence on your personality. Both of those things have to have an effect on the brain if they're going to have a lasting effect on, you know, the way that you behave and experience the world.
So researchers are increasingly making use of more advanced imaging tech to look brain by brain, to get at individual differences, which that's where personality lives.
What you can start to figure out is like, why are people acting the way that they are, having the kind of experience that they are, right? So if we know that somebody is fearful and anxious and somebody else is always calm in the face of danger, like, why is that? And what about their actual functioning as an organism allows that one person to be so calm and the other person to be so anxious?
And that's a key driver for Colin and others in this field to learn more about personality. Because on some level, our personalities determine the lives we get to live.
Probably, you know, just to generalize, probably your personality shapes your experience more than your experience shapes your personality.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Does your personality shape your experiences, or is it the other way around? It's a tough question to answer, and it seems to be a two-way street, a constant push and pull. Science journalist Olga Hassan feels like her experiences in life did shape her personality, specifically the fact that she felt like an outsider.
So I have always felt like a weirdo. I am a Russian Jewish immigrant, and I grew up in Midland, Texas, which is in far west Texas.
Olga's family moved to Texas when she was 4, and they did not fit in.
It's West Texas. Football is really big. If you've seen Friday Night Lights, that's the area that I grew up in. People are very religious. In particular, most people are evangelical Christian. So the fact that my family wasn't Christian, we weren't into football and we didn't have horses and things like that, definitely set us apart. And so I pretty much lived my whole life feeling like I was different from everyone else.
Olga wrote a book about that feeling. It's called Weird: The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Is there a story or an event that you remember where that feeling of weird hit you the first time, or maybe hit you in a big way?
It sounds silly, but this time that everyone in my classes was to sit outside the school cafeteria waiting to for our turn to eat lunch. And my parents told my teacher that I wasn't allowed to sit with everyone else because Russians believe that sitting on cold things will make you sick. And so they put their foot down about this and told them that I wasn't allowed to do this. And so, of course, I was already the new kid in class, and it was just even more scrutiny, and questions were asked about why I wasn't sitting with everyone else and why Russians believe this about cold things. And of course, as a kid, you can't really explain it. So yeah, I would say things like that just sort of subtly kind of set me apart from everyone else.
Yeah, I'm German, and we're also not allowed to sit on cold things. I totally remember that.
Someone in that part of the world must have sat on a cold thing once, and they were like, that's it, no more, I don't know.
For Olga, that weird label stuck all through high school. Was there anything about you, yourself, that made you an outsider other than, you came from a different place and your parents were different, but was there anything about your personality that made you different?
I think it was a little bit of both, honestly. I think I was defined as weird by other people, and then I also think I kind of carried that forward and honestly became kind of weird because I just didn't have a lot of the interactions that a lot of other kids have when they're younger.
Why do you think this label of weird can be so scary? You know, it's the last thing, especially when you're a kid, it's the last thing you want to hear is somebody say, you're weird. So what makes that so scary?
Yeah, I think that, we love normalcy. People really, really love it when things follow the rules, in particular tight cultures, which just means really rule following cultures, tend to really, uphold strong norms and really, appreciate people who follow kind of the rules of society. And we really don't like it when people break those rules or when people do something unexpected or something that isn't like what we would have done. You see that in a small way every day on, social media, where people are like, why did you say that? That's not what I would have said. But, with kids in particular, it's you're just learning kind of how to exist in the world, and everything around you tells you that it's good to follow the rules. So when you encounter someone who's not following the rules, you kind of have this startle reflex, oh my God, what are they doing? So I think that's why that being called weird or being thought of as weird can be so difficult.
For her book, Olga talked to people who were outsiders in different ways. A Muslim living in a Christian town, a male preschool teacher, an Amish woman who left her community.
They were different from everyone else around them because they were doing something different. They believed something different. They had a different identity than everyone else they knew.
Did you see any traits in people who embraced this label of being weird? Anything about their personalities that struck you?
Yeah. So one thing I noticed is that they were very sure of what motivated them and what they wanted. So this chapter called Truth in my book, where I write about how basically a lot of the people that I interviewed had this process of having to determine exactly what it is they believe. And they had to find that and kind of stick to it. So one guy was a missionary, a Mormon missionary, in Bulgaria, which has very few Mormons and very few religious people in general. And he basically had to like decide in this process of being rejected over and over and over again by Bulgarians, and being told that like he didn't need to be spreading his message in their country, he kind of ended up deciding, you know, I am not so sure about my message either. And he actually ended up leaving the Mormon church because he kind of like was forced to question it over and over and over again. You know, at the same time, there was another Mormon missionary that I talked to who went to the Czech Republic, another very atheistic country, and he found that it reinforced his belief and his devotion to his religion because, again, he was forced to question it over and over and over again. And the quote that he gave me was, when you're the odd man out, you have to decide what you believe. And I feel like that's something that all of these people that I talked to had in common, is that they all had to go through this soul-searching process and be like, do I really want to be doing this or not? And that, I think, ultimately made them stronger.
So if you want to be the odd man out and you embrace that, is that in your mind related to strength of personality?
It can be, yeah. I mean, a lot of the people that I talked to had a strong sense of like, this is what I want in life, this is what I'm going for, and this is what I'm going to do. And they kind of didn't let all of the social anxieties and social issues stand in their way.
Did you also meet people who were defined as weird and then really tried to change themselves so that they would fit in?
Yeah, I in particular was really interested in the story of this guy, Kurt. Nothing in particular was strange about him except that he has a birth defect on his arm. So his arm looks a little different than most people's. And it's pretty noticeable. And that birth defect made him a little bit shy throughout his childhood and throughout his young adult life. And he basically decided to change his shyness. So he kind of decided to just like completely become a different person at one point. He decided to sign up for public speaking opportunities. He signed up for going abroad. He, like, as an adult, you know, once he actually was out in the world, he would go to bars by himself and just randomly talk to people. He became really, really extroverted because he realized that that is how he wanted to live life and that's what he thought would make him happy.
Did you learn any strategies in talking to people who changed their personality in terms of what works?
Yeah, you have to behave in the way of the personality that you want. So it's called the as-if principle. So you have to behave as if you are that person. So if you, let's say you decide that you want to be more open to new experiences, right? That's one of the big five personality traits. You have to kind of behave as if you already are. So that means making the reservation at the restaurant with the food that you're not sure you're really going to like. That means, you know, when it's safe to travel again, traveling to the, you know, destination that you're kind of like a little bit maybe scared of, like maybe you aren't so sure about it. Trying the activity that your partner suggests, even though it's not the old standby. You have to actually behave in those ways, and then ultimately your personality will follow.
So dress for the job you want sort of thing?
A little bit, yeah.
Now, what is good about being weird? You say, you know, that we can embrace this and use it to our advantage. How do we do that?
Yeah, so being weird can also be really good for creativity. There's a lot of research showing that being rejected, even in a research setting, like if a researcher tells you, you don't belong with this group, you'll then sit down and come up with a lot more creative ideas and creative solutions than someone who's told, like, you fit right in with the group. You know, you think about the like rebel kind of mentality where you're like, oh yeah, well, I'll show you. And so you come up with really interesting ideas and solutions because you already know that you're not going to be following the rules of the group.
That's science journalist Olga Hassan. She writes for The Atlantic, and her new book is Weird: The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. She says after high school, she moved away from her small town to Washington, D.C. And while she still feels like an outsider, it's less so.
People went from saying Olga is a weird name to people saying Olga is a cool name. I literally think that's really, it's a small thing, but it made such a big difference for me to not have my first interaction with someone be them saying that I don't belong, and instead them saying that I am cool.
We're talking about personality, how we define it, where it comes from, and how our personalities shape our experiences. Or is it the other way around? That was something I talked about with Johnny Bunning. He is a historian of science and right now a fellow at the University of Chicago. And he said, consider the root of the word personality.
The word personality comes from Latin, of persona. It's actually a theatrical term. Persona means mask in Latin. So there's a tension between the sense of playing the role of a certain character and having a certain interior state.
So if you had to place personality, is it internal or external? Does my personality come from how I see myself, or does it come more from how others see me?
Well, I think it's both, actually. And it's both because the way that one sees oneself is often using psychological terms to describe oneself, justify oneself, interpret one's own actions. So I think that it's neither one nor the other, but it's both. But you could argue that the both is in a kind of dynamic relationship. It's not both at the same time, but one sort of informs the other, which informs the other.
So if I lived completely isolated on an island by myself, I would still have a personality, right?
Well, in some sense, we can only recognize ourselves through the alienation from our own subjectivity, right? That I recognize that I am I and not someone else in the confrontation with the other person. And in psychology, the classic mirror stage is in fact the confrontation with oneself as an infant and one's reflection, which in that moment of alienation to realize that one is also an object and not just a pure subject, that one actually creates one's own subjectivity. Now, that's like slightly off topic here, but I would suggest that if one was on an island, the concept or the idea or need for personality as such wouldn't apply.
There's no point in identifying as an introvert or extrovert, as open to new experiences or not, when you're the only one there. The desire to define ourselves, to be in one group or another, comes from others. Reporter Micah Hazel noticed this as she moved from one phase of life into the next and changed friends. And it felt like she was a different person with each group.
Some events are made for our personalities to shine. My favorite are parties. I love watching them on screen.
Is this enough to get 20 people plastered?
I adore getting dressed up to go to them.
Best dressed, here I come.
But the caveat is, I'm terrified of throwing my own party. It's not the logistics that scare me. I know how to prep food, send directions, and make a pretty poppin' playlist. What scares me is the thought of all of my friends from so many different phases in my life, high school, college, and every random encounter in between, gathering in a room and having to keep up the same personality I have around each of them. Growing up, my personality has gone through phases. In high school, I stuck to the books and only my closest friends. This is one of them, Carrie.
You're calm, cool, collected, you know, very studious.
In college, I stuck to myself. My friend Bailey could attest to this.
I would have to forcibly put myself in your door jam in order for you to speak to me for the first 2 months of our relationship.
But by grad school, I'd come out of my shell more. I partied more. And as my friend Caitlin knows, I found it easier to meet new people.
Anytime it was like a social thing with our group, you were always in that mix. You came and met Like, my roommates who you didn't know. I think you knew all of my roommates I lived with in grad school.
I've managed to keep friends from all eras of my life, but I'm still self-conscious of how I act around each of them. If I'm around my high school friends, I feel like I need to be more subdued and straight-laced like I was in high school. But if I'm around a friend from grad school, I need to stick to a more vibrant, partier personality. When I scoured the internet, I saw that other people had the exact same concerns. This is Ask Nikki, an advice column from YouTube.
Oftentimes, if people are around other people who knew them when they were younger and more immature, they can tend to revert to that because it's almost like this feeling of like that's the relationship that they knew with them, that's maybe what they were comfortable with them, or sometimes this feeling of like that's how I have to act around them.
Psychologists have a name for this: social selves.
I think of social selves as the idea that we sort of unconsciously but naturally present different sides of ourselves or have different experience of ourselves depending on the person or the group that we're interacting with.
This is psychologist Michael Wiederman from the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
You know, in our own head, we have this sort of consistent sense of self that I am who I am regardless. And I may not be aware that ultimately, though, each person or group that I'm interacting with is probably experiencing different aspects of me, not the entire package.
Our social selves are twofold. We make social selves, creating them during each interaction as a way of displaying the personality we want to have, matching the mood of whoever we're in contact with, or matching the energy that the other person is looking for. And everyone we interact with creates a social self for us as well. An understanding of our personality filtered through their own judgment, desires, and mood.
If I ask, you know, five friends to rate me on different personality characteristics, they've seen different sides of me. Each of their experience has also been filtered through their personality and their expectations. And so even if these five friends have had all exactly the same interactions with me, we've never done anything apart, they've always watched everything that I do and so forth, they have their own sort of stories, if you will, built up around who I am based on their first impressions of me.
So having a personality that comes across differently to each friend is actually completely okay. But why am I afraid to bring everyone together in one place, one party? Why am I always worried about who the real me is?
I think there's this need to be accepted by others.
That's therapist and counselor Funto Iwole.
And there's this notion that if you're real, people accept you more. You have a certain higher social value if you come up as real and woke and all that stuff. But what does that really mean? And I think it might mean different things to different people.
And Funto says that being real is not what we think it is.
The truth is we actually have no control over what other people think of us. We can't change their point of view. We might be able to influence it with the way we act, but changing it, it's solely up to them.
If we're concerned about how our friends perceive us, something we cannot change, Funto says it might be time to reassess what our values are.
So values are those qualities about you that matter to you. So qualities that you want to stand up for, qualities that are important to you, that gives your life a sense of meaning. And not because your parents think they should be important, not because friends think they should be important, but what is important to you as a person.
We're always going to have multiple sides of our personality, sometimes competing. The most important part is that our personality, shifty and complicated as it may be, reflects what we value. I may be more subdued and chill around my high school friends because that's what I value in our relationship. We could have the greatest day ever doing practically nothing at all. And with my grad school friends, I may tend to be louder and want to party a lot because I value how we all have this mutual hunger for new experiences. Social distancing means I won't be throwing a party anytime soon, sorry. But when I do, I don't think I'll be as worried about my personality anymore.
That's reporter Micah Hazel. We're talking about personality, and we've heard about some of the outside factors that can alter it. But what can we do to change our personality traits? And is there a healthy personality? Alan Yu looked into it.
There are many self-help books that promise to transform your life and make you the kind of person you want to be. Kristen Meinzer has read and tried many of them for years for her podcast By the Book, which she hosts with Jolenta Greenberg. They spend 2 weeks living by a book at a time, from the extreme...
In one episode, I move traffic with my mind. In one, I regress back to my childhood.
To fasting...
The book launches with 48 hours of eating nothing except water that you boil leeks in.
To decluttering...
Boxes and boxes and boxes of books down to the curb to give away to my neighbors.
To small changes...
Both Jolenta and I finally memorized our husband's phone numbers.
Despite spending so much time on self-improvement, Kristen is actually pretty happy with herself and her life.
I mostly at this point in my life don't hate myself. I mostly at this point in my life laugh every day. I have what some people call resting jolly face. I don't have resting bitch face. I smile a lot. I practice acts of kindness as often as possible.
At the same time, she still enjoys the adventures through self-help books. She says there is no danger of running out, because every year there's a fresh supply of books that promise to make you happy in all manner of ways, from decorating your house the right way to being more productive at work. But the books are marketed as if they can apply to anyone, which she is skeptical of.
Jolenta always says nobody is more of an expert in being you than you. So this author doesn't know who you are. Why would they know what's best for you?
The self-help fiction is a great example for why I think it would be better to rely on our research than on the literature that is currently there, because there's very little that is really evidence-based.
Wiebke Bleidorn is a psychologist at the University of California, Davis. She studies personality development. Of course, psychologists have also tried to figure out how to make people happy over the years. The way some of them have put it is, what is a healthy personality? This was a popular line of research in the 1950s and 60s. Psychologists had all kinds of ideas. Maybe a healthy personality meant someone who is emotionally secure, or works responsibly, or has connections to other people, or pursues meaningful goals.
What was missing to a certain degree was a more systematic research, meaning that often theories at that level remained philosophical in the sense that there was little data to go by.
Wiebke took a different approach. She recently asked a panel of psychologists and a group of college students to describe a healthy personality. The panel came up with this definition. A healthy personality means someone who can experience and express emotion, is friendly, confident in themselves, and resilient to stress. She emphasizes this is a description. It does not mean that if you do not have this personality, then you are unhealthy. But then, as people get older, they also get closer to something called the normative personality. They get calmer, more responsible, more compassionate.
So these are all very good news in terms of how people age on average.
Rodica Damian is a psychologist at the University of Houston. She has studied personality change over decades. Her team looked at a sample of more than 1,000 people who had their personalities assessed in 1960, then again 50 years later in 2010. Her research suggests that over time, people get closer to the average or the norm in their group.
Are you going to stay weird in your own way later on? And the answer to that is yes, but to a less extent. So that implies that maybe there is, as we age, a little bit of pressure to become more like we're expected to be in our society.
Bear in mind, these are averages drawn from a specific sample of Americans who were in high school in 1960. You cannot use them to predict how things will go for any one person. The idea of someone's personality getting closer to the average as they age sounded a little strange to me, but personalities change in response to all kinds of experiences. In particular, life stages common to many societies, like going to school and getting a job.
School can help you increase in conscientiousness because you are learning how to be a more responsible person that can deliver a product by a certain time. And that is, to some extent, school is an intervention on conscientiousness without us realizing it.
So there are all these things that can change our personalities over time, some of them out of our control, but some are things we can take into our own hands. For instance, therapy has a remarkable effect on someone's personality, according to psychologist Brent Roberts.
By seeing a therapist, you get essentially a half of a life of change in terms of amount.
That is, by comparing how much people thought their personality changed after therapy to how much they thought their personality changed over years. Vibeke Blydorn says that by studying healthy personalities and personality changes, it could lead to an evidence-based, generalizable answer to becoming the kind of person you want to be, fulfilling the promise of decades of self-help books.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. You're listening to The Pulse. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, a dramatic event transforms a shy teenager.
Now, it doesn't matter who you are. Whatever I'm thinking is coming out of my mouth.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about personalities, how they change over time, and what changes them. Sometimes it's a dramatic event that has a huge impact on personality. Earlier on the show, we talked about different brain regions that seem to be connected to personality traits, and that connection comes into play with our next story. When Jordan Emerson was 13, she was a member of the Whiz Kids race team. They raced four-cylinder compact cars on a small NASCAR racetrack in Scarborough, Maine. During one race in 2007, Jordan's car spun off the track and slammed into the outside wall. On impact, she hit her head, she cracked her left hip, she broke her left shoulder, and she fell into a coma. At the hospital, doctors discovered that she had traumatic brain injury, and they predicted that, at best, she would live in a vegetative state, never to walk or speak again. Reporter Jack Pombriant takes it from here.
For about 3 months, Jordan Emerson's life was on pause. Her friends and family held their breath, waiting for her to come out of the coma. Then one afternoon, her dad and her uncle came to visit her. They were hanging out in the hospital room and having a loud conversation.
And then I was like, shut the hell up. And they looked at each other and were like, did you hear that? And a week later, I came out of my coma.
When Jordan fully awoke, she noticed some changes in her personality.
I would flip people off. I would bite them. I would hit them.
She had a lot to be angry about. Her world had completely changed. Jordan's entire left side, stomach, and vocal cords were all paralyzed. She had to relearn all sorts of basic skills, such as eating, walking, talking, and even crying. Adjusting to this new reality wasn't easy.
Oh, I was very angry with the world. Like, I knew this was gonna be a long road.
There were some other, more endearing personality changes, too.
Now I'm, like, fun-loving, random, quirky, silly. Like, wanting to meet new people.
This was very different from how she was before the accident. Jordan used to be extremely shy. She hated talking to strangers and meeting new people.
If someone talked to me I didn't know, I'd start crying.
Personality change following a brain injury isn't uncommon, but what exactly caused all these shifts?
You can't discount the fact that traumatic brain injury creates such significant shift in the world.
Ashley Moore is a clinician and visiting assistant lecturer in the psychology department at the University of New England.
The question becomes, is this an inherent change in an individual, or is this a shift that this individual has taken on to adapt because they've had to?
The doctor said Jordan's brain was shaken like a baby rattle during the accident. The parts that were most affected were her frontal lobes and cerebellum. The frontal lobes are the emotional control center of the brain. This is where personality lives.
Before the accident, my emotions, like, I felt them, but I could put them aside. And after the accident, now it, like, consumes my whole body.
She was left with a lack of empathy and motivation.
It's still a constant battle. It's just been my parents, like, hounding me. Like, you have to do this. You have to do that.
Jordan also lost her filter.
Now, it doesn't matter who you are. Whatever I'm thinking is coming out of my mouth.
She has embraced this change. The shy 13-year-old she was before the accident had turned into an outgoing, sociable person.
And having the freedom to be someone new and be like, hey, I'm here. Wanna hang out?
For the most part, these changes are still with her. Jordan is now 26 years old. It's been 12 years since the accident. She's still largely uninhibited and outgoing. But, like ripples from the event, some of her traits continued to change over the following years. As Jordan focused on recovery, her condition improved and her anger faded. And something else happened too.
As my brain developed and rewired, I grew empathy. Like me saying something and seeing people's emotions and seeing their reaction, I was like, ooh, I didn't mean to make them feel that way.
It's possible some of these changes may not have been related to her traumatic brain injury. They could have just been part of what happens to our personalities as we get older.
Right around ages 10 to 15, right in that transition into adolescence, you actually see some dips in some positive traits and agreeableness and conscientiousness, but then things rebound after that in the high school years.
Christopher Soto researches personality change at the Colby Personality Lab in Waterville, Maine. It turns out that adolescents aren't the only ones who experience personality changes. He found that over the course of adulthood, people generally tend to become more agreeable, conscientious, and emotionally stable. Today, Jordan lives alone in an apartment with her dog, Maisie. They recently started going on daily walks, just the two of them.
She's my emotional support animal. She helps me, like, when I get, like, really sad or isolated.
Jordan has had tremendous support throughout her recovery, especially from her parents. It's still a long road, but today she's light years beyond where doctors thought she'd be.
I've created this person that I would want to be friends with if I met them somewhere.
That story was reported by Jack Pombriant. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund, PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.